Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. We're recording this on November 23rd, 2016, and you're listening to episode 10. Politicoast is the podcast that explores what's happening in British Columbia and around the country. If you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or wherever you found this podcast. And follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ian. First up, we had a question from our new Twitter friend, Bernard Von Schulman, who's giving some great political rants on YouTube that everyone should check out, and we'll leave a link in the show notes for him. He asked us, after we put a call out for thoughts and questions about tonight's episode, what our thoughts are on the story about journalists and media personalities, particularly television personalities, running for the BC Liberal caucus. There was some criticism in the Taii from NDP strategist Bill Thielemann about the sort of blurring of the lines between the media and the government. What do you think on that?
Yeah, it's definitely a concern. You don't want to give the appearance of bias or kind of a quid pro quo. On the other hand, it's not exactly unprecedented. Our current federal trade minister was a former journalist who I believe actually ran against another journalist in Linda McQuaig, who was running for the NDP when she got elected. So it's not out of the question, but it does, especially this late into a mandate, and when they've been in power this long, it does raise some concerns.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure on the media, mainstream media right now. It's sort of shrinking budgets, Post media is laying off lots of journalists at a time. So naturally, I imagine some are exploring other options. Now, going from the unstable career in journalism to probably maybe even a less stable career in politics maybe isn't for everyone, but I don't think it's the giant credibility problem. Like, people will naturally go from different sources. I think the bigger issue that Thielemann sort of looks at in his piece is the sort of financial ties, the amount of donations coming from certain parties to the BC Liberals specifically. And that's just a broader problem in BC politics, where there's a lot of big money going in and no, at least, effort on the BC Liberals to either be transparent about what influence that buys them or effort to maybe get that out. At least the BC NDP and the Greens have been long consistent in their opposition. Bernard's other questions related to the what's happening with the BC Conservative Party. And I guess the quick answer is just literally nothing, because they're imploding, as we mentioned a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, they still don't have a leader who, after he got booted on a technicality on the most recent leadership vote. And as far as we can tell, they're basically dead in the water.
Which will, I think, play interesting into the next election, because you won't have I don't think there was a giant right-wing split in BC in the last provincial election. But there was the chance of that. The Conservatives were sort of on the upswing until they collapsed during the election campaign. And they're not even starting from that medium level this time. They're sort of nowhere to be found. And so they're not going to be a force. I think it's going to be a very traditional NDP versus everyone else in one party election, which plays really well for Christy Clark, because it's just a one-on-one comparison she has to make.
Well, I'm not necessarily sure that's the case. You have the Green Party making up a lot of ground and kind of coming in the forefront. They're the other party in the legislature, currently with one seat. And Andrew Weaver is definitely making a play for the center, trying to be that reasonable middle ground voice who, for the people who aren't necessarily thrilled with the prospect of an NDP government, but are pretty tired of the Liberals after a decade and a half.
What I'm going to be watching for is the possibility of a green meltdown. We know that the Green Party does tend to attract a sort of fringy, anti-science crowd, not universally, but enough so that what's going to happen when the first questionable statements about Wi-Fi come out, or someone, you know, puts their foot in their mouth about vaccines or something else? Is Andrew Weaver just going to axe him from the party, or is he going to take a more, well, we're all welcome in the Green Party approach?
I'm not sure if he's going to necessarily axe him from the party, but if you look at what he's done over the past year, he's very much tried to distance the party from that. It's made some noticeable steps away from Elizabeth May and trying to separate the BC Green Party from the federal Green Party and some of the more controversial positions they've taken.
So I guess the question will be what candidates he has before him. And as I guess we talked about, a couple of them look like they're sort of stars from the local scene. And I guess we'll have to find out if they proved to meet the muster at the provincial level. And I guess the last question we can just quickly touch on is, why don't people in Vancouver know who John Horgan is? He's a politician from the island. He represents a Vancouver Island seat, of course. And so I think he's got that profile there of being an MLA for a number of years and representing his constituency, I imagine, very well. But there is a sort of disconnect between island and Vancouver politics, I imagine. You could probably speak to that.
Yeah, the island does, to a certain extent, exist within its own bubble. He's from the South Island, so that's definitely more his home territory. Part of it, I think, is this is his first election campaign as leader. He's relatively new in the job. There hasn't been kind of a major thing to really push his name out there. And I think we'll see a lot more of it come the election time when things really kick off, the campaign really gets going. And I think the other thing, at least as far as Vancouver's concerned, is the big issue here is housing. And David Eby's really kind of taking up all the oxygen out of that one and being kind of the poster child for the NDP on that issue.
Yeah, he's definitely the local star. He's the one who can speak to those issues very genuinely and sincerely. He's got a great connection with the people of at least the city of Vancouver, I think. John Horgan, I think, also has the sort of problem where he's just the middle-of-the-road friendly guy. So he's not a NDP partisan in the way Adrian Dix was. That sort of really polarizes people. In the previous leadership convention, when he challenged against Adrian Dix, he represented that sort of middle-of-the-road path of, well, I'm not too extreme, I'll be your moderate guy, and that didn't really inspire people. So he, you know, didn't upset anyone, but also didn't rally anyone to the cause, so he sort of stayed below the surface a little bit. But we'll see if he's got the fight in him for the election. Bernard also asked a little bit about softwood lumber and some of the trade issues, and I think we'll bundle those and pin those thoughts and that discussion for a deeper dive on trade, because that's just opening a big can of worms that'll
take us off topic. We briefly touched on it in our post-US election discussion when the possible renegotiation of NAFTA came up. And we'll go into more detail, as you said, a little later on a different episode. But general gist of it is there's definitely been some talk from the Trump transition team that softwood lumber would be a major component of their renegotiations. So we're going to have to keep an eye on it, because that is a continual sore spot and a not insignificant part of the BC economy.
Yeah, we don't want to drive the province into a recession. All right, going into our first story, Justin Trudeau announced this week his plan to phase out coal power across the country. This sort of builds on the carbon tax plan, which we criticize as not being ambitious enough to actually do anything, and he sort of alluded to additional steps that would help Canada reach its Paris commitments. And so the idea here is that by 2030, 90% of Canadian emissions will be greenhouse gas free, is the goal.
Yeah, and that represents a step up from the current 80%. So it is some, but it's not that huge step. Of course, this is kind of the low-hanging target. Coal's basically the dirtiest source of power out there, and getting rid of that goes a long way. That's one of the reasons Ontario's actually led the country in reducing greenhouse gases, is because they did the coal power phase-out.
Well, and Alberta's also put the phase-out of coal power on its sort of agenda, and I think this accelerates it a little bit. Other provinces like BC and Quebec have had so much hydropower, we've never had a coal plant. Or I looked up for this story whether we even had any coal in the province, and yes, we do, but most of our coal actually goes to making steel, so even the mines in BC aren't really tied up in the get it out of the ground and burn it. It's using it for better purposes.
Yeah, we do have a couple thermal plants in the province for electricity generation, but they are gas powered. We don't use coal here at all, and even those runs are run intermittently, primarily for peak loads and low water seasons when the dams can't produce quite as much.
So overall, this plan should prove fairly popular in BC and not really affect our economy much or really put much of a hamper on British Columbia. The other aspect of this plan is that the government recognizes some provinces, notably Nova Scotia already, are going to have difficulty meeting its targets. But they've arranged a deal where as long as the province can meet those climate commitments another way, they could keep a coal plant on past 2030. So Nova Scotia's already reached one of those deals. This isn't good enough for Brad Wall, who just is opposed to any action on climate change. So he's just being Brad Wall, of course.
Yeah, Brad Wall's basically being opposed to any action on the climate file across the board. He has been pushing the clean coal angle, so it is, in theory, possible. We'll have to wait for a few more details to come out, whether or not this will meet the equivalency requirements. So, in theory, Saskatchewan could continue to produce electricity with coal, provided they use the carbon capture. They already have one plant up and running with it right now, although the economics of that are still a little questionable. Yeah, probably less so once the carbon tax hits.
Yeah, it's definitely something I saw when I was researching this segment. A lot of the coal industry is really pushing carbon capture and storage because I think it's the only way they could keep coal plants open is to capture that carbon. But I know even when I grew up in Alberta, that was the pipe dream of Ralph Klein and successive progressive conservative governments, and they dumped a lot of money into it with not much to show.
Yeah, and in my opinion, this is most likely going to be a dead end as far as addressing climate change. There are, in theory, some advances that could happen that'll push the cost down to a reasonable level, but based on the current trajectory, it's not looking like it's going to be a very feasible way of going about it. And not only that, there's just a whole lot of other emissions that comes with coal. Even if coal produced zero greenhouse gases, we'd still want to get rid of it just for all the other pollution that comes out of it.
That's a very important point. I've looked up in the past, because there's a lot of criticism for the nuclear industry and for nuclear power plants, but nuclear power is one of the ones we actually treat as an adult, where we put strict regulations around it and we make an effort to contain the waste. So very few people have died from nuclear power, and those are people who were near Chernobyl, pretty much. Whereas coal power, you just live near one, your chance of getting cancer, lung cancer, or other health-related issues skyrockets.
Yeah, in terms of death per terawatt hour, coal is one of the deadliest forms of power out there. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense to get rid of it, even if there wasn't a climate change urgency to it anyway.
I guess the last final point I'll make on the phase out of coal is it's not likely to hurt the Liberals. The places where, as Eric Grenier points out in his sort of poll analysis of this, the places where coal is either mined or the power plants exist are not Liberal ridings. They're rural Conservative ridings. In some cases, they're Northern BC NDP ridings. They're not places that Justin Trudeau needs to win vote.
Okay, moving on. The Globe and Mail came out this week with an in-depth investigation on what's happening with the BC Agricultural Land Reserve and the developments going on there.
This is really interesting. I found it as a sort of exclusive investigation that they've been doing, and full credit to the Globe and Mail for the work they've done on investigating the housing crisis in BC. Metro Vancouver and BC has long had an agricultural land reserve, a sort of throwback to the 1970s NDP government, I believe, that set aside parts of BC so that we would have food. They basically said, Metro Vancouver is very fertile land, but it's also very popular land because it's a place a lot of people want to move. So they wanted to balance these by saying, all right, we're going to cordon off big chunks of space that we say, this has to be farmland for eternity. And there's specific rules about what you can do with it. What the Globe and Mail found is that a lot of that land in Metro Vancouver is not actually being farmed, about half of it. And that's according to Metro Vancouver's own numbers. And even worse than that, a lot of these farms are being speculatively invested almost. They go for a lot cheaper than a mansion because of the restrictions on them. But realtors are advertising them sort of deceptively. They're saying these are good development opportunities. And then what's happening is investors are buying these, putting up mansions, paying very few taxes because it's an agricultural rather than a residential property tax. And in some cases, they're even putting up hotels, which is astonishing.
Yeah. For an area of such strict zoning codes, it's actually surprising you can put up a hotel on residential, or actually put up a hotel on agricultural land. But yeah, you mentioned the tax thing, and that's what really jumped out at me on this, is how these places are getting taxed as farms. And because of the way the BC tax law works, is that farms are assessed on the value of the land and its use for agriculture, not the actual selling price or market value of the land. So a lot of these places are assessed at a fraction of what they're selling for, and then taxed quite low because of that. And in order to meet those requirements, you only have to have $2,500 of agricultural revenue per year to be considered a farm, which is a really low amount.
And I don't even know how strict they've been on that. It sounded like a lot may not even be meeting that requirement, or where they do, they sort of do the bare minimum, which on a very large amount of land, you're not buying the sort of property the size of a Vancouver house lot. You're buying a field and putting up a mansion in the corner of it. You're getting people who are basically just taking advantage. And so a quick back-of-the-envelope calculation in this article found that even just flipping the tax rate from the agricultural to the residential, not even reassessing the land, would generate an additional $2 million in revenue for Metro Vancouver municipalities in property taxes. This also sort of ties into the foreign buyers' concerns, because what the Globe and Mail found is that a lot of these have been bought by overseas investors or shell companies. Some are going through the Cayman Islands, others are coming from Hong Kong, and the provincial government says, well, the 15% foreign buyers tax will apply to that, but if the amount they're paying is a fraction of what they're using it for.
Yeah, and some of these are structured so that the company is registered to a Canadian, buys the land, and then they sell shares in the company to foreign investors, and that's not considered a sale of the real estate. It is supposed to be subject to this sort of thing, and they're, in theory, are enforcement mechanisms to try and address that, but they're not very well applied.
The other thing I found really interesting in this investigation is the journalist spoke to the former chair of the Agricultural Land Reserve, Mr. Bullock, which is an awesome name. He was sharply critical of pretty much everyone. He was critical of the government for essentially letting this happen. He was really critical of realtors who he said they were bloody lying about the kind of things you can do with this land, just sort of misrepresenting that you could develop a hotel on a farm. None of it really points to a solution for me, but it's another angle on the sort of housing crisis we're having, and it's something that I look forward to seeing how the government and opposition respond.
Yeah, this is one of those areas where crafting effective policy is quite difficult. You want agricultural uses to be incentivized, so that low tax rate does kind of make sense. I mean, I also get the argument that you don't want to distort incentives too much by taxing different things at different rates, but if you want to use the limited amount of farmland for farming, that lower tax rate does make sense. And you also want people to be able to live on their farm. So having some residential development, you know, at one house per farm also made sense, but clearly this is not working. And how exactly you craft a policy to not have mansions on acres of farmland is a tricky proposition, and you don't want to just create a whole bunch of red tape and have, you know, bylaw enforcement coming by every other week to check your farm yields and everything.
Well, I could definitely see this from the sort of ideological point of view, where a libertarian or even just right-leaning government would not develop the agricultural land reserve. This is frankly a leftover from an NDP government of the 70s, which if we elected the NDP in the spring, they're not going to undertake this level of sort of socialization. This is essentially nationalizing a bunch of land and saying, we're not going to own this as a government, but we're going to severely restrict what you can do with this. That's not, I don't expect them to do that. And so it's sort of this holdover that if the liberals wanted to tear it down, that would be sort of ideologically consistent. I could see them making those arguments and say, look, the free market should just decide. But I think it's really popular. I think there's a lot of people who go, we do need food. This was the right thing to do. And so
there's less of an argument for it now just because the population growth in Metro Vancouver. About a year or two ago, I saw a study on this. I don't know if there's any more recent information on it, but basically the current land supply that's in theory agricultural can basically just meet the population's demand for food under favorable conditions. And 20 years from now, when we're expecting another million people in Metro Vancouver, we're not going to be self-sufficient in food. Currently a lot of agricultural trade, we export some, we import a lot of food. But in the future, even if we were to go all self-sustaining and only consume locally, that's just not a practical approach anymore. So you can, in theory, see the government making that case. But as you said, it's very politically unpopular. And that's why I think they're kind of shying away from doing the unpopular thing that they probably want to do. And instead are just kind of not really enforcing the current policy all that well.
It's the same criticism that they've received over public education, where instead of taking that sort of ideological bent that the critics say they want to and, you know, just privatizing the education system in province, they're sort of death by a thousand cuts to the public education system, you know, strip contract rights, sort of flatline funding for year after year, and meanwhile expand options and choice in the independent school sector. It's those little actions that, you know, no one action is ideological, but the long term can fuel a narrative that could bite them. So I haven't seen any political responses to this. This story only really came out on Sunday, and they didn't really get into what position any of the parties will be taking. So I guess we'll have to watch for that. All right, a few quick stories just to wrap up today. The first is Justin Trudeau has announced we're going to be buying some fighter jets.
Yeah, we're buying the F-18 Super Hornets, 18 of them, to supplement our current fleet of the CF-18s.
We don't know how much they're going to cost.
Yeah, the details are still a little sparse on this in terms of how much it's going to cost to purchase them, what the ongoing operational costs are. There are some differences between these Hornets and the ones we currently fly. There's been upgrades to the airframes, the avionics, a whole bunch of other stuff.
They're not 35 years old.
Yeah, well, not only are they new, they're a different aircraft that, yeah, has a lot of superficial similarities, but functionally speaking, there's a lot of differences there. And what are the operational costs of maintaining a 35-year-old air fleet and a new air fleet concurrently? And then what will that mean when we actually get a full new fleet of fighters?
The big issue here was during the Harper government's era, they tried to buy new fighters, only they told Parliament it was going to cost one thing, and then it turned out it was going to cost a lot more, and they seem to have made up their mind before they did a procurement process, and the Liberals and NDP sharply criticized them. This was, I think, one of the things that led to the contempt of Parliament ruling that the opposition parties got together on. They said, look, you lied to us. You said it was going to cost this much, and instead it's going to cost double. And the Liberals campaigned on we'll run an open, transparent procurement process, but we're going to exclude the F-35s that Harper wanted, which was always a weird...
It was a bad promise to make. I'm glad they've walked that one back.
Well, it was a bad promise to make that they've now broken, because they're buying an entirely different plane and saying then they'll get to this sort of 5-year open procurement process. And they aren't telling us how much these planes cost.
Yeah, and part of the problem right now is that the CF-18s are just old. Airframes can only be up in the air for so long before you have metal fatigue. And there's a lot of money being spent right now to try and assess and address those fatigue concerns in the current airframes. And the fact is, we need new fighters now. And I remember when I was looking at joining the Air Force, that 2017 was when we were going to be getting the 35s. That was kind of, 8 years ago, that was kind of the in theory when we were going to be getting the F-35s. And that didn't end up happening. We don't even really have a contract inked yet for what we'll be getting to replace the current CF-18s. But we do have these issues. Our fleet's decreased in size just through attrition as airframes wear out or there's been crashes. The initial 182 we got are now significantly less. We're having trouble meeting our NATO commitments, our NORAD commitments, while still doing the proper maintenance and training required on this. So we need to expand the current fighter fleet. But this, on the other hand, makes no sense to me because now we have a whole bunch of new aircraft we're going to probably going to be keeping around for a while, and then we'll either have to buy a aircraft that's at the end of its production cycle that's going to be obsolete in a decade or two, and we'll probably be flying the next fighters for 35 to 40 years. And what's that going to mean? Does this mean we're going to be buying Super Hornets for the full-on replacement, or are we going to be buying F-35s and then having all the cost of two aircraft, or are we going to retire these ones early and not get the full use out of the airframes?
Well, and even with the 5-year procurement process that will eventually start, we're going to see at least a change in defense minister in there, probably, and an election. So that could then turn into an 8-year process if someone new comes in and says we should be doing it this way. And so the Liberals have really just shot themselves in the foot here and given the gun over to the Conservatives to finish the job, because they can then say, well, you wrecked our process, now you're wrecking your own process, and meanwhile you're saying you're defending the troops, but you're not even giving them the materials they're asking for, begging for.
Yeah, Aaron O'Toole's already running attacks against the Liberals on this one. Former Air Force officer currently running for the Conservative leadership, he's hammering this point. And I definitely expect the Conservatives to hit this point hard in 2019. But at the same time, this whole 5-year thing, I think that's been a little optimistic. If one thing has been shown time and time again is that defense procurements are more expensive and take longer than anyone ever anticipates. I mean, we're just now getting the replacements for the Sea Kings that started in the Mulroney government. And similar things, a lot of other issues are Fitzwin's search and rescue craft. They needed replacing 10 years ago. We're literally scrounging museum pieces to find parts for our search and rescue equipment. And the list just goes on and on of procurement after procurement that has been mismanaged, slowed down, and to the point where everything's all screwed up. And if there's one thing that any government needs to do to get defense right, it's to fix the procurement process, because everything else is getting screwed up badly because of that.
Well, I don't think I can add anything on to that.
Sorry, I do have one other point I want to make on this, which is, yeah, the Harper government badly mismanaged both the public relations thing and some of the dot in the I's and crossing the T's on the F-35 thing, but basically everybody knew we were eventually going to be moving towards the F-35. It's basically the only NATO fifth generation fighter that everybody's really on board with. There's a lot of interoperability gains to be made from all of our allies also moving to that. It has the technology that's going to be needed 20 or 30 years from now that the other stuff, such as the Super Hornet, just doesn't have and will be obsolete in a couple decades. So they took a lot of flak for sole sourcing it, but there weren't many other good options out there that really meets the needs, not just in the short term, but in a couple decades from now when we'll almost certainly be still flying whatever we buy.
All right. Well, speaking of not having too many good options, the NDP leadership race has gone from almost having one person to almost maybe having two people, as the National Post is reporting that MP Charlie Angus from Ontario might throw his hat in the ring. and they describe him as a socialist punk rocker with a big heart. And I did see him on Facebook not confirm that. He is just calling it speculation right now. But he did say he would consider having that description engraved on his tombstone when he dies, because it's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, just to add on to that, he announced today that he was stepping down as NDP caucus chair, which is the precursor to announcing a leadership run, because basically all the parties have rules that you can't have leadership or critic positions while seeking party leadership.
Right. We saw a couple weeks ago Peter Julian step down as House leader to explore a leadership bid. And so this is Charlie's sort of same path. He's very well liked, as far as I can tell, within the NDP circles. He's popular, he's charismatic to some extent, and I think he has a good sort of touch between the rural sort of working class, as it were, part of the NDP, and some of the more urban progressives. I don't know if he can perfectly bridge that divide, but I know there are people who are very excited by him potentially entering the race, I guess.
Yeah, it definitely appears he's making the steps to do that. Now, from what I gather, his French skills aren't all that great, and that could potentially be a problem, particularly as the NDP is looking to hold the gains they've made in Quebec and potentially try and build up to a second orange wave.
That'll definitely be something to look into. I know I wasn't sure about it at first, but Peter Julian does say he's fully bilingual, so he's at least got that going. Unfortunately for Peter Julian, he's not doing well in a poll from Forum Research that was just published in Hill Times. He is the sort of bottom of five candidates who were listed as possible NDP leaders. Two of those candidates, Alexandre Bolloris from Quebec and Nathan Cullen, have both said they're not going to run, and they're both the most popular candidates among all Canadians. They don't do quite as well among just NDP supporters. Charlie Angus actually leads that with 10% of NDP supporters. The problem with this poll is everyone's within sort of 5 points in that national ranking, and everyone's within like 4 points in the NDP supporters. And within the NDP supporters, there's a 7.5% margin of error. So everyone's tied. No one stands out.
And when the unsure is at 50% and the none of the above is at 24, it's a wide open race at this point. That is, if people are actually to enter the race.
And of course, this is a poll of the general public and then people who say they support the NDP. It's not a poll of NDP members who will actually be voting. And of course, each of these candidates will be trying to sign a whole bunch of people up, because the NDP leadership race is a one member, one vote. So if you can sign up a million people, you can probably win the NDP leadership right now. And they can be a million people in Vancouver, or they could be a million people in Toronto, or they could be a million people in Montreal.
Yeah, unlike the conservative one we talked about, there's no waiting by riding in this. So just racking those raw numbers up really matters.
So it'll be interesting to watch, but no one's officially in the race yet. To close off, two quick and relatively big spending announcements. The Metro Vancouver mayors today announced that the phase one of the Metro Vancouver transit plan has been approved. It's roughly a $2 billion plan that will put more buses on the street, another C bus on the route, I guess, and sort of reroute and improve the overall, sort of improve within the existing conditions, the overall transit system. This isn't going to open the Broadway subway line, but it'll start some of the pre-construction. And the same in Surrey. It's not going to build the light rail that they need there. It's going to start the process.
Yeah, there'll be other gains on the rail line. They're adding 50 new SkyTrain cars. They're increasing Candoline service, as well as Millennium Expo and Evergreen Line service during the midday evenings and weekends. So they're already basically running trains as close together as they can at peak hours. But now they're going to increase service during off-peak. They're adding 5 new B-line routes, bringing in 171 new buses. You mentioned the C-bus already. So overall, there's just a lot more transit vehicles coming online and more routes going to be put in.
Yeah, it's really adding capacity to the existing network and sort of optimizing everything, as far as I can tell, and getting ready for the next stage. The next stage, I think, is what everyone's really looking forward to. the like new subways and the new light rails, but this will probably help a lot because there's a lot of congestion on specific routes.
Yeah, there's definitely some gains to be made there for sure. But like you're saying, the Broadway subway line is the one everybody kind of has their eye on. I believe I mentioned this before, but the 99B line that currently services that corridor is the busiest bus line in North America, and it's basically at capacity right now.
I mean, we're very biased. We're recording this in Kitsilano, and so we both have to take that bus quite frequently, and it's always hell.
Yeah, but at the same time, the Broadway corridor is the second largest employment center in the province after downtown Vancouver, and the fact that it doesn't have a SkyTrain line servicing it, and Port Moody does seem a little odd in terms of what the priorities are.
So this will be funded by a split between the federal, provincial, and municipal governments. Most of the money actually has to come from the municipal level, as I read, and that's going to come from a small property tax increase, fare increases, and just some money TransLink found under the mattress.
Yeah, so this is a welcome change. It's disappointing it took a year after the defeated transit referendum to get things going, but it's a step in the right direction, and we'll definitely be keeping an eye on there, particularly what's happened with the pre-construction work on the Broadway subway.
And I guess as this is phase one, this really pitches the next couple phases into the election coming up, and so we'll have to see what kind of promises get tossed around by the political parties to fund those, because I don't think anyone knows where that money is coming from yet. Well, speaking of money getting thrown around, the other announcement was yesterday the BC Liberals are going to be throwing money at affordable housing. This comes off an announcement they made in September that they'd put $500 million towards affordable housing projects, and yesterday's announcement was sort of the specifics of who's getting what. It seems like it was a fairly positive announcement. There were no real complaints. 22 of the 68 proposals they approved are in the Lower Mainland and Fraser Valley, and that'll open up an additional 1,441 units for people on fixed incomes, people with disabilities, women, marginalized communities. And overall, it seems like a positive story. I'm sort of wondering myself just why only a third of the projects are in Metro Van when there is such a high need here and we do represent half the province.
Yeah, it's definitely a concern. From what I gather, they're prioritizing kind of ready-to-go projects. And as you can well imagine with what real estate prices are like and what the market's doing right now, it's hard to find land and easy space to build out these projects in Metro Vancouver. So in part of the rush to get things ready for the election coming up, they're going to be starting work, I think, on some maybe not quite as optimal places, but where the shovels can be in the ground sooner.
And the cynics can also wonder if this is just sort of putting money into the more liberal ridings to try to shore up votes, or if it's more equitable. And I haven't seen the breakdowns either way. I think there was some concern about that, but it's always a question you have to ask, especially months out from an election.
Yeah, the election stuff's definitely a concern. And I think my bigger concern here isn't so much the political angle as the policy side of it is, yes, housing affordability is a big issue, but you know, these are kind of a drop in the bucket in terms of what's actually needed. And if you're not going to try and bring housing in general down to a more affordable level, it's going to be harder to make the gains on these projects for low-income people too, because everything else is kind of sucking up all the available space and resources for that. The land you need to acquire is a whole lot more expensive. I can see the point in targeting specific stuff, but if it's not part of a broader strategy, it's not really going to address the fundamental problem. And that has been Politicoast. Make sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at PoliticoastPod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. And if you have any ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.
We've done 10 episodes.